Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang on Thursday Live. The theme that we have picked today is Becoming Mahavira. Vira is defined as one who is brave, or more so, Vira is a victor, and therefore Mahavira refers to that one who has achieved a great victory. Maha means great and Vira is a victor. So, a great victor. And it is no secret or suspense as to why we have picked this theme for today. We have picked this theme because today is a very, very, very special day, the most special day possibly for all our Jain brothers and sisters around the globe. Today is Mahavir Jayanti, the day they celebrate as to commemorate the birth of the 24th Tirthankara, that is Vardhamana Mahavira, Bhagwan Vardhamana Mahavira. Now, what is a Tirthankara? Who is a Tirthankara? All of this will follow in the satsang that comes. But we would like to begin by sending our greetings and wishes with all prayers in our heart to all our Jain brothers and sisters around the globe on this holy and happy occasion of Mahavir Jayanti. Mahavira was born as Vardhamana, but he became Mahavira. So what is it that makes a person Mahavira? How do we become a Mahavira? All of that is waiting in the satsang to follow. We, as always, begin by offering our humble salutations at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan, thanking him for this beautiful inspiration and all the content that he provides in his own ways for all our satsangs. With that, let me welcome, as always, Brother Prem, Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and let me join you in extending our hearty greetings to all those who are celebrating today as Mahavir Jayanti. And it's a pleasure for us to speak on this topic because, as we often say, it's quite rare that on a Thursday we have a festival or an occasion like this.
Or a birthday like we had a few weeks ago.
So we can combine it together and we can speak on that. You know, it's always, I don't think otherwise we would have picked up this topic to speak on. So I think it was purely Swami's inspiration that we could go through this thing. Because one thing is, you know, we take it for granted when we are in Swami's presence that all religions are the same. They're all different paths to the same divinity. But we don't probably sometimes appreciate this idea of how different the paths can be. And when Swami says paths are many but God is one, we don't really understand how contrasting some of the paths can be. And when you go through that and you realize that still
the spirit is the same.
Right, the spirit is the same, the God you finally reach is the same, the goal of the path. In fact, if you look at Jainism, it's one of those religions which do not speak of an embodied God or a personality of Godhead. And we'll go into that eventually. But even otherwise, the goal that you are heading towards or you're aspiring to reach is pretty much the same. And that's the interesting thing. And when we go through it, we know how many people of the Jain faith have become devotees of Swami. I think we've all had classmates and teachers and people who have from this faith who have had no issues or problems in looking up to Swami as their master. So that itself shows that it's worthwhile to go into all of these scriptures and all of these different religious tenets, because they somewhere you find resonance with Swami's message. And the thing with most of these religions is the emphasis are different on different aspects of the teachings. Like, you know, being Swami's devotee, there's somebody who says that seva is more important. Somebody who says that, you know, soham meditation is more important, or jyoti meditation is more important. Or someone who says, no, you just have to love Swami. So within the body of devotees of Swami itself, there are so many people with different preferences. And that's what we see in different religions, that the preferences given or the emphasis laid on certain tenets are different. And that's what makes the path itself different.
And like you said, you know, we often make this kind of assumption that because all paths lead to the same goal, as long as we speak about the goal, it's fine. But all said and done, Prem, even when Swami was delivering a discourse, he would speak about Ganesha, he would speak about Shiva, and we would listen to it with interest. But somehow when he speaks about Swami, I mean he speaks about himself, we feel more thrilled, we feel extra special, though I know that Shiva and Ganesha and Rama and Krishna and Swami are all the same. Honestly, I feel a greater thrill when I hear Swami speak about Swami more than Rama or Krishna. And that is solely because of my special preference to this form of God. Though born as a Hindu, from early childhood I have been exposed to Swami and Swami has become my everything, because of which I find a special thrill when somebody mentions Swami. In fact, even if I go to some other religious place or a spiritual place or a master or anybody, somehow my respect or regard for that place or that person goes up higher if they happen to have regard for Swami. That is the way it is. So I feel that when we have a wide array of people, you know, who have love for different forms and names, though they accept that all are the same, they definitely feel a thrill when they hear the name of Krishna or Rama for that matter. And that is why Swami made it a point to ensure that the bhajan group every day sings bhajans of different godheads and compulsorily includes at least one Sarvadharma bhajan. You know, the bhajans are having a variety not only in the tunes and beats and the speed, but also in the godheads that they are singing the glory of. Because Swami said that there will be different people having love for different names and forms. Nobody should go unsatiated from this spiritual feast. So also, you know, as you said, because we forget that variety sometimes, we focus only on a few things and don't realize that, like today, if we take up on Bhagwan Mahavira, it will give that special joy to those people who adore and worship this form, this path. And therefore, as you said, we are grateful to Swami for making a Thursday into a Mahavir Jayanti and inspiring us to take up this satsang on becoming Mahavira, which of course begins with, I think, a description of Bhagwan Vardhamana Mahavira himself.
Before we go into the life of Mahavira, I think one more thing which occurs to me, and which is actually central to the concept of Jainism itself, mm-hmm. and in fact every other religion. In Jainism, I think we'll come to that eventually. There is that statement which even has a mention in the symbol of Jainism, which is popularly used today. It says,
Paraspara upagraho jivanam. Jivanam.
Right. Yeah. Paraspara upagraho jivanam, which means it is very similar to what Swami would say of paropakarartham idam shariram, where the idea is
the literal translation of that statement is the function of souls is to help one another.
Right. The idea that you are one part in the whole and your function in this creation is to be of help to others, to understand others' issues, and to live in harmony, you know. And I mean, this is mentioned in everything, be it Buddhism or the other religions, Hinduism, the idea of tolerance, the idea of sahanam, or what Swami would refer to as shama. All of that is very, very important in the path of a religious seeker or a spiritual seeker for that matter. And that is why it is sometimes important to understand where people come from. Somebody who is brought up in a tradition of Jainism, the way they will react will be based on some of these learnings they've been brought up with from their childhood. So that way, when we read about their religion, read about the kind of things they give importance to, it becomes so much more easier to relate to them. Though we know that eventually we all are united in a manner which you cannot deny, but you're able to relate to them. And for the simple fact that if we are going to go and speak to a group of youngsters, you know, you have this concept in modern culture where they say YOLO, you only live once. If you want to appeal to that kind of a mass, you have to understand where they come from. You know, the kind of ideas they come with, the kind of, even if it's something which you don't agree with, you have to understand where it comes from so that you can relate to them with the message that you speak. So I think it's very important for us to look at all these religions. That's why Swami makes it important that we also understand where our brethren come from, their ideas and their concepts.
Before we go into the life of Vardhamana Mahavira, before going into his teachings, I think, Prem, it would be nice to play that one discourse clip wherein Swami is so beautifully singing a poem which says that all are different names and forms of the same Godhead, and yet there are people who adore one particular name and form, and it is this diversity that has to be celebrated and not suffered with.
Right, and this was how Swami began his discourse on the Christmas of 1996. So we listen to that very beautiful and profound poem that Swami recites.
Vishnuve goppani Vaishnulanu chunda Tembundu goppani Teivulanaga.
Vaishnavites say that Lord Vishnu is greatest, while Saivites claim that Shambhu Shiva is greatest of all.
Vishnuve goppani Vaishnulanu chunda Shambhundu goppani Teivulanaga. Ganapati goppani Ganapatulu balka Sharadi goppani Chaduvarulana.
Those that follow that school of Ganapati, they claim that Ganapati is the only Lord, while all educated feel that Sharada is the highest deity.
Allah Ganundanchu Allah Turakalu Cheppa Maku Kristu Vatanchu Christulana.
Muslims claim that Allah is the mightiest Lord, while Christians say Christ is the Lord.
Buddhude goppani Buddhude goppani Bauddhulanu chunda Mahavira goppani Mahavira goppani Buddhulanaga.
The Buddhists say Lord Buddha, and Jains say that Mahavir is great.
Jorastra goppani Parasinu jeppa Govindu goppani Nanaku goppani Sikkulanaga.
The Parsis say that Jorastra is great, while Sikhs say that Nanak is great.
Saiye goppani Baba bhaktulu cheppa Andarokkateyani kondaranaga.
Baba devotees say that Sai Baba is the Lord, while few say that all are equal.
Sarvamata sammatam vaina Devudu kade.
God is one acceptable to all religions.
Atade satyamu Atade dharmamu Atade shantiyu Atade premaswarupudu.
That God is truth, that God is righteousness, that God is peace, that God is love.
And so, that is the beautiful poem which I don't think we need to dilate, because it's also simple and clear. Swami says, be any name or form, everybody embodies the principle and the spirit of truth, satya, dharma, righteousness, shanti, peace, prema. Embodying these, and an embodiment of all these, is called by different names and given different forms by different religions, but it makes it very clear that it is the spirit of satya, dharma and shanti, prema that is most important. And it is this spirit that we see even in Vardhamana. That was his birth name. He is supposed to have been born to King Siddhartha and Queen Trishala. Now, before we go into that story, a little bit about Vardhamana Mahavira. He is said to be the 24th Tirthankara of Jainism. Now, the word Tirthankara, it signifies the founder of a Tirtha, What's a Tirtha? Tirtha is a fordable passage across the sea of interminable births and deaths. Also called samsara in Jainism, just as we know it in Hinduism. So, a Tirthankara finds a path, a fordable passage across the sea, across this Bhavasagara. So, Vardhamana Mahavira is the 24th Tirthankara. And the first Tirthankara was Rishabhanatha. And he is said to have lived millions and millions, billions of years ago, in fact. So, the interesting thing, Prem, is out of these 24 Tirthankaras, 22 of them happened to belong to the Ikshvaku dynasty. And almost half of them, that is 11 of them, were born in and around the city of Ayodhya. So, you know, in that sense, Ayodhya is so important even for the Jains, because one, as I said, 11 out of their, half of their Tirthankaras, or those who made this fordable passage across this ocean of misery, the Bhavasagara, 11 of them were born in that city, and 22 of them belong to the Ikshvaku clan, the same clan to which even Lord Rama belonged to. Interestingly, even King Suddhodana and Prince Siddhartha, who later became the Buddha, they too belong to the same Ikshvaku clan. So, amazing clan, you know, the members of whom have given support to three different religions.
Right, absolutely. And I think probably a small word about the central idea of Jainism and from where the concept of Tirthankaras actually come into fit into that whole philosophy. According to the Jain belief, there are two things. One is the jiva and the ajiva, or what we refer to as the soul and material or matter. And just like how the soul is eternal, they believe even the ajiva is also eternal. That is, the manifest world is also considered to be eternal. And the moment you say the material world is eternal, then there is no creator to the world. Only when there is a beginning for creation, then you have a concept of a creator who creates the world. And, you know, that's how the concept of God comes. So they, according to their belief, they do not have a personality or of Godhead. They don't have somebody who has created the world. But you have this eternal cycle of the jiva and the ajiva, the material and the soul. But it is all about the progression of the soul through these various lives. So they believe in the concept of karma. And through the process of
and
karma
even rebirth,
and
right?
rebirth. And so you through the process of this rebirth and the many cycles of karma that you undergo, you eventually reach a state where you are absolutely pure and you reach a state of absolute knowledge or you of omniscience.
Kevala
jnana, they say. And the person who reaches that is supposed to be a perfected soul. And among those perfected souls, some actually come back to teach others to, as you beautifully explained, Tirthankara, who give the modus operandi to go across this ocean of birth and death. And they become Tirthankaras or gurus who come to aid the other people to make that same journey that they have made.
Exactly. There are many who actually manage to themselves cross the Bhavasagara,
right,
as per Jain belief. Those people who manage to cross are called Jinas.
Right.
And that is where the word Jain is also derived from. But not all Jinas are Tirthankaras, because there are many, many Jinas. But as you said, some of them who are such selfless beings that having crossed, they actually come back and they start what is called a Sangha. A Sangha is, in Sanskrit, it means a society. It's exactly the same. A Sangha is a group of like-minded people who would wish to pursue this and go across the Bhavasagara or Samsara. They call Samsara. They don't use the term Bhavasagara.
Right.
I'm mixing it up because of my background. That's it. So, when they come back and start a Sangha and they help others also to cross, then they become a Tirthankara. So, it is like how I remember what Bhagya sir says often, that Swami told him, it is not enough if you get moksha or mukti. Help 10 others to get moksha or mukti, that is important. So, that is possibly what makes a Tirthankara stand out, because not only does a Tirthankara do it for himself or herself, but also comes back to help others. And in this way, Prem, actually, if you look at it, there's a lot of things common between Jain and Hindu history. One thing is they date back to billions of years. And you know, often you feel it is like the same thing that the Puranas speak and what Jain belief speaks of, but in a different perspective. Rishabhanatha is there in the Puranas also. Rishabhadeva, I mean. And Rishabhadeva...
We had spoken about him when we were talking about the Amshavatar, the thing.
Correct.
Where they said that it is possibly the same personality which is being referred to.
Referred to, yes. Right. So it is like the same person and same situation being seen from a different perspective. Interestingly, I came across something called the Jain Ramayana. Mm-hmm. Now see, in the Jain Ramayana, it's, if you just directly look at it, it's very radical and it's shocking. Okay. Because in the Jain Ramayana, for instance, Rama doesn't kill Ravana.
Okay.
And Sita is Ravana's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it is Lakshmana who kills Ravana. Okay. And if you go back to it, it is almost like, you know, it has been made in line with their main important tenet or teaching, which is Ahimsa. So when they say Ahimsa is the greatest dharma, Ahimsa is most important, they cannot afford to glorify Rama when he kills Ravana. So interestingly, as per the Jain Ramayana, Lakshmana kills Ravana, because of which Lakshmana and Ravana both go to hell in quotes, and they are to be reborn as Tirthankaras in their future birth, while Rama doesn't harm anybody and he is a perfected being. You know, it's very interesting, but it just shows how, in order to emphasize on one particular tenet, or the same thing is seen from different perspectives. And this, in fact, is another principle, another important principle in Jainism, which is known as Anekantavad.
Right.
Anekantavad means many-sidedness. It is like how we give the example of the five blind men touching the elephant and describing different parts. So here, they accept that the same thing can be viewed in different perspectives. So though they have a Jain Ramayana, which is radically different from the Ramayana, the Jains don't have a problem in accepting the other Ramayana, the Valmiki Ramayana that we have. They have no problems in it, because a true Jain firmly believes in this thing called the Anekantavad.
Right. And actually, it's a very interesting concept, this Anekantavad, because it is very similar to what we speak of in the Vedantic wisdom, where they say that, you know, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Vadanti.
And Swami would say it as Munde Munde Matir Binna.
Right. Depending on the number of people who approach the same truth, the way it is described is so different. And the pretext of it is very similar to what Vedanta says. They say that the truth is beyond the realm of language. So when you speak of the truth, when you convert it into human language, some part of its profundity is lost. So what is spoken is never the absolute truth. And that is why whoever comes and speaks the truth will never be able to portray the truth in its entirety.
By default.
Right. So when they speak of it, they always say probably. And there is a word for that in the particular language, where they say that it is everything that is said is prefixed with probably. And I mean, the comparative study of some of these is very, very interesting. In fact, just like how Tirthankaras, we spoke of them as those perfected beings who come back to help others. Even in Buddhism, you have the idea of bodhisattvas, where they are enlightened, but they are also here to help the others. But where it differs is, you know, in Buddhism, you always speak of the middle path, where Buddha said that, you know, don't go to the extremes. No extreme indulgence, no extreme renunciation also, but you take the middle path. But here, the Jain philosophy is, you can either be this or that. You know, you can, it is suggested that you become a renunciant, but you can be a man of the world also. Probably this will lead, probably that will not lead. You know, even while putting it across, it is put across in that manner. And that is the essence of that, the concept of there are multiple ways of looking at the same truth or the same path.
So, unconsciously, from the young age itself, those who are brought up with this philosophy strongly, humility gets imbibed automatically. Because by default, you don't consider your wisdom or your way of thinking or your perspective as the only perspective. So, that is one wonderful thing, because with firm conviction in Anekantavad, you automatically... Vada Vivad stops off. I mean, the argumentation stops off, because, yeah, probably it is that. Probably you are right. Probably I am right. So it doesn't matter. It's wonderful, that philosophy. But as I said, there's a lot in common between the Sanatana Dharma and Jain belief. Because they too believe that their first Tirthankara, Rishabhadeva, lived long time ago. Long meaning billions of years of years ago. Just to give you an idea, they have a measurement of time called Purva. And one Purva, you know, I just cut down the zeros to make it easy to understand. One Purva equals about 70,500 billion years. Okay. So one Purva is 70,500 billion years. And Rishabhadeva, Deva is God, Natha is Lord, anyway. So Rishabhanatha is supposed to have lived for 84 lakh Purvas. So 84 lakh into 70,500 billion years. Okay, not 1 billion. So that's a colossally huge period of
just
time.
Just to put that in perspective, I think 13.7 billion years ago is the Big Bang, according to our cosmology.
So when we look at that, we look at the cycle of creation happening over and over again. We say that Yuga comes, the Kalpa comes, and so we have multiple cycles, and possibly this Yuga or this Kalpa began 13.6 billion years ago.
Right.
So as you said, they don't have a beginning and an end. They don't have a thing. So that old is Rishabhanatha. And another interesting thing, Prem, is I found that in every description of these Tirthankaras, for some reason they have included their age and their height.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Rishabhanatha's height was 500 dhanushas. Dhanusha is a bow. And one dhanusha is supposed to be 3 meters. So 500 dhanusha means Rishabhanatha was 1.5 kilometers tall. Mm-hmm. And as we go through these Tirthankaras, you see that height keeps reducing. The second Tirthankara, I forget his name now, but from 500 dhanusha, he becomes 450 dhanusha. It keeps coming down, coming down, coming down, coming down. By the time we reach Mahavira, Mahavira is supposed to have been born in 599 BC, 600 years before Jesus Christ. His height is 7 hatha. Hatha is supposed to be hand. So 7 hatha, 1 hatha is 1.5 feet. So Vardhamana Mahavira comes to something like about 10 feet. So from 1.5 kilometer tall being, you come down to 10 feet being. Why I find it interesting is because, you see, we often use the term Ajanubahu for Lord Sri Rama.
Right.
And Lord Sri Rama, according to this Jain chronology, he comes somewhere in between the 19th and 20th Tirthankaras.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so therefore, you can see the height has kept decreasing. And when you see the 20th Tirthankara, his height is something like about 40 feet or something. So Rama, you can imagine, is like some 50 feet tall maybe, you know, if you see in that sense also. So it makes so much sense like that. But anyway, that is the thing. So Rishabhanatha on one end, the first Tirthankara, he was 500 dhanusha or 1.5 kilometers tall and lived for 84 lakh Purvas. While Vardhamana Mahavira, the last Tirthankara, he lived for about 72 years and was about 7 hatha tall or 10 feet tall.
Right, and today we will be primarily focusing on the 24th Tirthankara, or who was born as Vardhamana and who became Mahavira. What is the significance of that title which he got, Mahavira, which is itself a very important and beautiful message to all of us. Because Vira means one who is valorous and one who is brave. We often relate that to somebody who is more powerful physically, who can probably defeat another in battle or stand against a wild animal. But the reason why he was given the title Mahavira was because, as Swami says, he had conquered himself, which is supposed to be the greatest of all conquerors.
He conquered the animals roaming within.
Right, the senses which are more difficult to conquer. And Swami would often say that is the true sign of bravery or true sign of victory. And rightly he has been named Mahavira because he is one who has conquered the enemies which are meant to be conquered rather than the enemies outside. And it's a beautiful thing because I think everybody goes through a struggle. When the struggle is outside, it results in violence which they do not agree with. But when the struggle is turned inward and you start battling the foes inside, you first of all avoid violence of any kind. And you also progress in this journey.
You know, very interesting. Because just this Ugadi, when we heard Swami's message, Swami is mentioning how Adi Shankara, asked all his disciples, tell me who is the true Veera, one who is a true conqueror.
Mm-hmm.
See, when we say Veera, and the first the translation that comes is brave. But one other meaning of Veera is a victor, as you said, you know. So when you say Mahavira, one who has achieved the great victory, one who is a great conqueror. And when Adi, in the discourse which we heard on Ugadi Day, Swami says that Adi Shankara asked who is a great conqueror, and different people said different things. Those who are able to cross the Himalayas, and then Adi Shankara replies that even birds are able to cross the Himalayas, fly across, so what's so great? Finally, Adi Shankara says that one who has complete mastery over the senses, he is the true conqueror. So you see, as we said, everything finally comes down to the same thing. It's just told in a different perspective, the Anekantavad philosophy. So that is what Mahavira did. And in fact, in that sense, dear listeners, Prem has given out the secret or the suspense that we wanted to keep till the end of the satsang. Becoming Mahavira actually involves first subduing the senses, then mastering the senses, finally going beyond the senses. That is how we become a true Mahavira. And we will look into the life of Mahavira and then how it went about and his teachings. But all that after this little break. So don't go anywhere. After the break, we'll continue with this Mahavir Jayanti special.
महावीर नानक
राम
अल्लाह तुम ईश्वर भी तुम महावीर नानक राम महावीर नानक राम गौराष्ट्र येशु बुद्ध तुम हो सबके साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ धाम
सच्चिदानंद साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ धाम
ओ सच्चिदानंद साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ धाम तुम ईश्वर फिर भी तुम महावीर नानक राम परतीश साई शंकरा तुम ही हो मेरे प्रातीश
साई शंकरा तुम ही हो मेरे प्रा
अल्लाह तुम ईश्वर भी तुम महावीर नानक राम
तुम ईश्वर भी तुम महावीर नानक
जो राष्ट्र यीशु बुद्ध तुम हो सबके पालन
राष्ट्र यीशु बुद्ध तुम हो सबके पालन
सच्चिदानंद साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ धाम
सच्चिदानंद साई
सच्चिदानंद साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ धाम
सच्चिदानंद साई तेरा वृंदावन शुभ
धाम अल्लाह तुम ईश्वर भी तुम महावीर नानक राम
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were about to start the story of Mahavira, who was born as Vardhamana. But before that, probably one more point we could make is, like most religions, even Jainism has different sects and it's broken up into, based on ideology, different groups of people. Two main sections of Jainism, which is which actually narrates the story of Mahavira itself quite differently in many aspects. I think that's why we thought it was necessary to mention that before we go into the life of Mahavira. They are the Shvetambaras and Digambaras. And translated literally, Shvetambaras are those who wear white clothes.
Ambara means clothes.
So Shweta is white. So Shvetambara are those who are white clad, to put it that way. Digambaras are, Dig also means
the sky clad
or those who are given to nudism. As a form of penance or asceticism, they are called the Digambaras. So those, I mean, the highest people in that particular section are either clad in white or they are people who are not wearing any clothes at all as a form of their asceticism. I think these are the two groups and they have their own differences in the version of the story of Mahavira as they narrate it.
And As per the Digambaras, Vardhamana was born in 582 BC, while the Shvetambaras say that he was born in 599 BC. So that is one thing. But both agree that he was born to King Siddhartha and Queen Trishala. While they agree to that, they don't agree on how it actually happened, because Shvetambaras believe that he was born in the womb of Queen Trishala. But the Digambaras believe that he was born in the womb of a Brahmin lady and he was transported from the womb of the Brahmin lady into the womb of Queen Trishala. So these are the two stories. But the thing is, Queen Trishala had an amazing dream, which according to the other version, even the other Brahmin woman also had the dream, in which different animals visited her. You know, there is the mount of Lord Indra. That is Airavata, and there is a deer. There are different animals. The interesting thing is, in Jainism, each of these animals represent a Tirthankara. If we visit a Jain temple and we look at that place where all the 24 Tirthankaras are kept, because I used to always wonder, how do you distinguish between the Tirthankaras? Because all of them look exactly the same. It's only during the research for this satsang that I got to know that under each Tirthankara, there is one animal. And that animal is a representative for you to know who that Tirthankara is. So, Rishabhanatha or Rishabhadeva is supposed to have the Airavata elephant in Lord Indra's elephant. And Vardhamana Mahavira has the lion under there. So if you see a lion under a Tirthankara, that is Mahavira. So interestingly, whether it's that Brahmin woman or this queen Trishala, both of them had a dream in which the symbolism is that the different Tirthankaras came and blessed. That itself was an indication that the baby coming now is going to be of Tirthankara material. You know, that was the kind of dream. Interestingly, as per the Digambaras, where Digambara tradition, where the baby is supposed to have been transported, they say that it was done by Lord Indra.
Right, and I think that is one more thing, the mention of Lord Indra and some of these other symbols like the Meru mountain, the Airavat, some of these things are mentioned very similar to the the Hindu texts. But when you're talking about this, I think one of the sutras which they follow, or one of the texts which they follow, is the Kalpa Sutra, which is supposed to be written few hundred years after the passing away of Mahavira. And in that, it is actually mentioned about this story of how Vardhamana is actually conceived by a Brahmin woman. I think her name is Devananda. She's a Brahmin woman. But Indra feels that if a person of such importance, a Tirthankara, is born in a Brahmin class, he might not have that kind of clout and influence compared to if he was born to a king. And that's why he is shifted to the royal family, the Ikshvaku clan. And as we mentioned, he was actually born as the second son of the king there. Again, this transfer is done by Indra, but even the Shvetambaras have a mention of how Indra plays a role in that, in childhood of Vardhamana.
Exactly. It is said that after Mahavira was born, God Indra came from the heavens, anointed him and performed his Abhisheka, consecration, on Mount Meru. So both Shvetambaras and Digambaras, though the details are different, they agree to the role of Lord Indra in the life of Vardhamana Mahavira. And these texts portray Mahavira as a very tall man, 7 cubits, we already spoke about 10 feet in height. Now, again, according to the Digambara tradition, Mahavira's parents wanted him to marry Yashoda. But Vardhamana refused. But according to the Shvetambara tradition, he got married to Yashoda at a young age. He had one daughter also, whose name was Priyadarshana. So, those are the two versions. Again, as per Shvetambara and Digambara tradition. But both of them agree that at the age of 30, Mahavira abandoned the comforts of royal life. He left his home and family to live an ascetic life in the pursuit of spiritual awakening. And if we actually go through the Acharanga Sutra, we will come across a very graphic description of the hardships and humiliations that Vardhamana faced during his 12 years of intense and rigorous penance. So after these 12 years, at the age of 43, Vardhamana became Mahavira. He achieved the state of Kevala Jnana. Kevala Jnana is that, actually in Sanskrit, Kevala means alone, only.
Right. So perfect, pure wisdom, pure knowledge.
They also call Kevala Jnana as infinite knowledge or omniscience. Omniscience, because it's pure knowledge, you know everything. So Vardhamana became Mahavira when he achieved the state of Kevala Jnana at the age of 43, and this happened under a sal tree.
Right.
So that was the beginning of Mahavira.
Right, and there's a very interesting incident which happens before this. He gets this enlightenment, where this again is, I think, supposed to be a kind of an experience which most of the Tirthankaras have. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Tirthankaras is a little different from probably, you know, the idea of avatars that we have, because avatar is always a divine descent. But here it is the culmination of a human ascent, where they say that the soul has progressed through many, many lifetimes, and it is almost like in the verge of perfection. And the Tirthankara life is that life in which that perfection happens. So it's almost like, you know, your 12th standard or your, you know, final year of your PhD or something like that.
Just to remember, Prem, let me make it a point to add that what you described now is a jina. But a Tirthankara is, after having achieved back and establishes a Sangha for others also to progress.
Right. And invariably it happens in that one lifetime where that perfection of knowledge happens. And then thereafter he continues to come back and discourse and guide the others. So it's that the moment of enlightenment and that person becoming a Tirthankara happens in this life. And after that 12 years, after he leaves his home and he takes sannyas, after 12 years, when just before he attains that enlightenment, he has a sequence of 10 dreams, each one having a certain significance. And in a very, very short span, he actually, one of the penance that he does is he does not sleep for more than 2 or 3 hours a day. And hardly any food, and they do not wear any clothes, and that's all the list of things that he does in the form of penance. But in that short while when he falls asleep, he has these 10 dreams. I'll probably just list out all those things that I mentioned. The first dream is that of defeating a lion, and that signifies the destruction of worldly attachment or moha. The second dream is that of a bird with white feathers following him, and that means that signifies the attainment of purity of mind. The third dream is that of a bird with multicolored feathers, and this signifies the attainment of the multifaceted knowledge, what we refer to as
Kevala Jnana.
The fourth dream is a 2-gem string appears in front, symbolizing the preaching of a dual religion, an amalgamation of principles for a monk's life as well as duties for a common man. That is again one of the important things of the Jain philosophy, where they're supposed to be able to guide a person into asceticism as well as to be able to lead a good life in society.
In fact, very interestingly, you know, as per the Jain tradition, Mahavira later classified people as Muni and Aryika. Muni is supposed to be monk, Aryika is a nun. So okay, that is the first category. And the others was Shravakas and Shravikas. So the translator is layman and laywomen, but these are the normal people, like right, those who go through life with everything without actually going through such intense austerities.
Right. And one of their duties is, of course, is to support those who have given up every form of worldly
pursuit. Monks and the nuns.
Right. So that was the fourth dream, where he sees 2-gem strings. The fifth one is a herd of white cows, and this symbolizes a group of devoted followers who will serve. And that is actually a sign of a Tirthankara, where he not only attains Kevala Jnana, but also will have a group of genuine followers. The sixth dream is a pond with open lotuses, symbolizing presence of celestial spirits who will propagate the cause. The seventh one is crossing of a waxy ocean by swimming, symbolizes freedom from cycle of birth and deaths.
Across samsara.
Across samsara. The eighth one is sun rays spreading in all directions, symbolizing attainment of Kevala Jnana or omniscience. And this is again a characteristic of the Jain belief, where Kevala Jnana is not only of Advaita Jnana, but of omniscience. You know everything about creation and everything about everything that is to be known. And it speaks of that Jnana as, you know, knowing of all aspects of life itself. The ninth dream is encircling the mountain with his bluish intestines. That is one of the dreams that he has, which symbolizes the universe itself being privy to the knowledge that he has gained. And I think it's so symbolic in that. The intestines actually goes around the entire universe. What you have gained and what you have digested.
You have digested the entire universe,
right,
correct.
And that is that has been shared with the entire universe. And the last dream is sitting on a throne placed on a summit of Mount Meru, symbolizes people revering the knowledge being taught and placing Mahavira in a place of respect, that he raises to that state of a Tirthankara. So these are the 10 dreams which he has in quick succession in a short while, just before he attains that Kevala Jnana.
And once he attains that, as indicated in his 10th dream, immediately he gets 11 disciples. The first 11 disciples that he gets are all Brahmins. And their names are also there: Gautama, Agnibhuti, Vayubhuti, Akampita, Aryavyakta, Sudharman, Manditaputra, Mauryaputra, Achalabhrata, Maitraya, and Prabhasa. These are the 11 Brahmins who become the first disciples of Mahavira. And you know, as we described his ascetic penance and austerities, it becomes clear that, you know, Kevala Jnana is just another term for a term that we have in Hinduism and Sanatana Dharma, which is Atma Jnana, because it is about realizing that you are not this body, you are beyond the body. Swami, in his discourse, as you pointed out in the beginning of the satsang, says that he conquered all his senses. It is impossible to conquer the senses till you rise above body consciousness. As long as you are in body consciousness, if you feel that you are the body, you simply cannot conquer the senses. You become a slave to the senses. Swami says, master the mind, be a mastermind. To master the mind, which is supposed to be the lord of the senses, you have to realize that you are not the body and you have to go beyond. And that is what is, I think, Kevala Jnana or Atma Jnana.
In fact, even in the Upanishads, you always come across this refrain. In fact, I think it's in the conversation between Shvetaketu and Uddalaka, where the father asks the son, who's become a little headweight because of the knowledge that he has acquired.
From Yama. Huh.
No, 12 years schooling.
I'm sorry, I confused it with Nachiketa.
Nachiketa, yeah. Shvetaketu. He comes back with, after 12 years of schooling, and he says that I've mastered the Vedas. So the father actually puts this question to him. Have you learnt that by learning which you learn all? And that is why the idea of Atmajnana being the idea of, you know, the knowledge of all is always there. So there is no difference between this Kevala Jnana being portrayed as omniscience, knowing all. In fact, the way Vedanta puts it is very beautiful. Everything in the world is made of one substance. If you know that one substance, you know everything. Just like the one who understands clay understands every form of pot which is made. So that is the idea of Atmajnana being one with the Kevala Jnana, what is referred to in Jainism.
And dear listeners, especially the Jains among our listeners, forgive both Prem and me for these frequent, because as I said, our knowledge about Jainism and this beautiful religion is just a few years old and in depth possibly just 2-3 days old.
Right.
And on the other hand, the other knowledge or information what we have got has somewhat got embedded in us, so it leaks through. So please forgive us for that, but we are able to appreciate the beautiful religion that Jainism is, how it is just nothing but another perspective of the same truth that we all adore and worship. According to the Jain tradition, you know, before he actually attained Nirvana, that state, that is when he left his body at the age of 72, Mahavira had 14,000 monks following him, 36,000 nuns, Arika, following him. He had about 159,000 Shravakas or laymen following him, and about 318,000 Shravikas or lay women following him. Even in that time, Prem, the women outnumbered the men 2-1.
I mean, extremely outnumbered, I think.
So, but you know, the amazing thing is, in matters of spiritual advancement as envisioned by Mahavira, both men and women are on equal footing. That is very, very important, because in those times, there was a slight misinterpretation, right, of Vedic knowledge, and it was considered that women should not learn Vedas. It's taboo for them. We know that is not the truth, because Swami...
Absolutely. In fact, the way Swami puts it is completely different from the way it is misinterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
Swami puts it like a woman who is the Lakshmi of the house, or the one who is caretaker of the house in the family, does not require the knowledge of Vedas. And I think that's a totally different idea of, you know, putting it across. You know,
yes,
she does not require to chant these mantras. She does not require to do penance, because
what
she is doing itself is much, much greater than a penance. I mean, that's why the man has to go and do all of these things to attain something which she attains just by doing her duty. And that is one of the things about Jainism, as you rightly pointed out. The equality between men and women in the spiritual realm was re-established through Mahavira's teachings, where he said that, you know, both, they're all souls. And the moment you talk about the idea that of reincarnation, of one going through many lifetimes, the idea of gender and all becomes very immaterial, because the soul travels through so many bodies and
Kshatriyas, so many genders,
and Brahmanas,
yes,
and, you know, the genders
keep changing. Yeah,
right, absolutely.
So that, in brief, dear listeners, was Vardhamana Mahavira's life. I think we'll take a quick break, after which we will go again briefly into some of his beautiful teachings. All the teachings are beautiful. We have time only to go into few of them. We will do that after this little break.
राम रहीम को भजने वाले तेरे पुजारी बाबा राम रहीम को भजने वाले तेरे पुजारी बाबा तेरा नाम एक सहारा हो तेरा नाम एक सहारा हो तेरा नाम एक सहारा तेरा नाम एक सहारा तेरा नाम एक सहारा तेरा नाम एक सहारा
Welcome back, dear listeners. Till now, on this beautiful day, on this holy day of Mahavir Jayanti, we have been discussing on the theme of becoming Mahavira. It's been a beautiful discussion on the life of Vardhamana Mahavira. We have, for those of us who are unaware, we have learnt some basics of this beautiful religion, Jainism. Coming to the teachings that is of paramount importance, we already spoke about Paraspara Upagraho Jivanam. But other than that, Jain monastics and renunciants and devout householders, you know, they have two kinds, as we already spoke of that also, renunciants and householders. They have, that is, those are the two gems that Mahavira saw in that dream before getting Kevala Jnana. So they undertake five main vows, which are also called as Ratas, Vrata. Again, another commonality, similarity, which is outlined in their oldest surviving text, which is the Acharanga Sutra. And what are these five ratas? It's very interesting because these five ratas also occur in the Ashtanga Yoga of Patanjali under the heading of Yama, the right. Five things. So it is exactly the same. It's amazing, interesting, and the similarity only highlights how all of us, though we worship different forms and names, we are all basically one. So the five vows or the vratas are ahimsa, non-violence, satya, truth, asteya, which is refraining from stealing. They also call it as achaurya. Chor also means to steal. So achaurya or asteya. Brahmacharya, which is chastity and celibacy. Again, see, it's beautiful. They define brahmacharya as celibacy or chastity. So for the monks and nuns, strict, it is celibacy.
Right.
For the householder, it is chastity. And finally, aparigraha, which is non-attachment, non-covetousness. So these are the five vratas. These principles have impacted Jain culture in many ways. And that is what has led them to choosing a predominantly vegetarian lifestyle that avoids harm to animals and in various forms of their life cycles also. So this is very paramount to the Jain way of life, the five vows or vratas.
Right, especially the idea of non-violence, I think really stands Jainism apart, because they go to any extent to do that. As you rightly said, first of all, non-vegetarian diet is completely not allowed in Jainism. Apart from that, there are a lot of other things also, even vegetarian foods they do not eat. For instance, some of the roots which grow under the earth, they do not eat, like what we generally consume, because of the belief that while uprooting them, you might actually be depriving life or sustenance for some other beings. That is one of the things they think of. And of course, like any other religion which emphasizes on discipline or control of the senses, I'm still talking about the practices followed by householders, where the idea of fasting is very, very important, where you eat once a day or twice a day, on different occasions they do that. But even for that, they say too much of fasting is not good, because in that, you know, paramounts to violence towards oneself.
Amounts to violence
towards oneself. So that also should be avoided. So that is the amount of emphasis which is laid on non-violence.
And of course, you know, the other thing that we see, you know, those who are very, very orthodox and strict Jains, they actually carry a kind of a broom with them wherever they go.
Right.
So that they sweep their path as they're walking to ensure that, you know, they don't inadvertently step onto some living being, some ant, some insects that are there. And also those, so they gently keep brushing, and they also wear a white face mask. It is in order to prevent unconscious breathing in. You know, sometimes it happens, you know, when you're riding a bike, a creature comes and lodges itself in your mouth, and however nasty or terrible you may feel, one thing certain is that creature is dead. Because, you know, you either spit it out or swallow it, you know, whatever. In order to prevent that, they wear a face mask across their nose and mouth. So, everything that is humanly possible, they do to ensure that they don't harm other beings. So, on one side, one important half of their philosophy is to help, is to hurt never. The other, of course, we saw paraspara graho jivanam, which is help ever. So, Jainism beautifully embodies help ever, hurt never. And another thing, as an extension of this help ever and hurt never, is what they have as the namokar mantra or the namaskar mantra. You know, their prayer itself, since they don't have a form of Godhead or anything, they have great reverence for the Tirthankaras, but they don't worship the Tirthankaras. They worship actually a kind of principle, and that is embodied in the Namaskara Mantra. The Namaskara Mantra is also called the Pancha Namaskara Mantra or the Navakara Mantra. And what happens is, while reciting this mantra, the devotee bows with respect to the Pancha Parameshti or the Supreme Five. And before we play that mantra for you, dear listeners, I'll just spell it out, because in the Satya Sai Vahini, Swami mentions this actually.
Right.
Swami mentions that the mantra is Om Namo Arihantanam, Om Namo Siddhanam, Om Namo Ayariyanam, Om Namo Ajayanam, Om Namo Loe Sabasadu Sahunam. and it translates as salutations to the great heroes who have conquered desire, salutations to those equipped with supernatural powers, salutations to the great masters of spiritual wisdom, salutations to the great teachers who transmit this wisdom, salutations to the good persons of all lands. What Swami would say as Yandaro Mahanubhavulu Andariku Vandanamulu. So that is this Pancha Namaskara mantra, which is very, very important for the Jains. And I think, Prem, you managed to extract one of that for our listeners and for
right.
us to hear.
So I think we should mention, I think it is from the Venus label, Venus Musics. And it's in the voice of Anuradha Podwal. We don't have the copyright for this, so we're mentioning that this is where we've taken it from. We will play that out. Of course, this is a very, very sacred hymn for the Jains. In fact, Swami in a discourse mentions that whoever listens to this or whoever chants this will attain a certain amount of calm and peace of mind. That's what Swami himself has said.
And it becomes extra special today because, dear listeners, as we play this Namaskara mantra, Pancha Namaskara mantra, and as we try to join in, we will be joining in all our Jain brethren across the globe, because on this day of Mahavira Jayanti, this is their regular prayer, and it becomes more special because today is Mahavira Jayanti. So we consider it as Swami's blessings that we are able to hear and participate in this mantra on this beautiful day.
Right. Probably just those three sentences where Swami speaks about this mantra in the Satyasai Vahini. Swami says, this fivefold adoration helps remove the evil effects of all sinful acts. Experiencing the meaning of this mantra gives one the sum of prosperity. The Jains declare that when one merges in this universal adoration, one is liberated and attains moksha. So we'll play that recording in the singer Anuradha Podwal's voice. This is from Venus Recordings.
Oh, For more entertainment, log on and subscribe to www.
Well, dear listeners, there.
So that clearly shows it's not our
content. Now, apart from the Tirthankaras in Jainism, there are many other inspirational beings. As I said, there are many jinas or those who attained Kevala Jnana. But to become a Tirthankara, you have to come back and do some social service or set up a Sangha. So, in India at least, especially South India, anybody who knows anything about Jainism, one thing that will come to their mind is Bahubali.
Right.
Because Bahubali is possibly the largest monolithic statue in South India. In India, I don't know what is its position in the world. It's a huge statue of Bahubali, also called Gommateshwara, because it's a Digambara. It's a Digambara idol where there's no clothes. And it's cut from a single rock, monolithic. It's huge, 35-40 feet tall statue at Shravana Belagola in Karnataka. And everybody will know this, and therefore his life story is amazing, because Bahubali was actually one among the 100 sons of Rishabhanatha. Rishabhanatha was the first Tirthankara.
Right.
Yes. So, when it is said that Rishabhanatha renounced his kingdom and he became a Digambara, and later he became a Tirthankara, he gave up, he renounced everything and distributed his kingdom to his 100 sons. Among the 100 sons, the eldest was Bharata. And Bharata set out in a conquest in all the directions with a huge army, and he had something called the Chakraratna. It was a wheel which is said to be undefeatable and it gets you victory. And he wanted to do, I think, what in Sanatana Dharma we will call as Ashwamedha Yaga or a Rajasuya Yagna,
okay,
where you establish, you become a Chakravarti after that. You're not just a king, you're a Chakravarti, you're a king of kings. And he did that, he conquered everybody, and he was returning back to his capital, which is Ayodhya Puri. It is said that this Chakraratna stopped outside the kingdom and didn't enter, refused to enter. And Bharata was told that he has to conquer his 99 brothers. He has to get their submission also, then only will he be a Chakravarti. Among the 99 brothers, 98 of them submitted to the elder brother. They actually became monks themselves. They gave up the entire kingdom, became renunciants and went into the path of attaining Kevala Jnana. It was only one brother who stood his ground. That was Bahubali.
Mm-hmm.
And Bahubali was known to be very powerful, very well-versed, very knowledgeable. So was Bharata. And when it became known that Bharata and Bahubali are going to have a war now, that is when everyone wondered who will survive this war. But since Bharata and Bahubali were both very, very wise and knowledgeable, they decided that it was futile to have a war in which so many will get killed. And you know, all said and done, they are sons of a Tirthankara, of a religion which considered Ahimsa as the Paramo Dharma, as the most important thing. So they decided that they would have a battle between themselves. And even this, they selected all the Ahimsa kind of battles. For example, they had Netra Yuddha. Netra Yuddha is you stare into each other's eyes till one of you blinks. That's it. So that was one Yuddha. Then they had Jala Yuddha, where you splash water on each other till one is unable to breathe. So whoever gives up first. And final third one is Malla Yuddha. Malla Yuddha is the classic wrestling. So Netra Yuddha, Jala Yuddha and Malla Yuddha. And it was decided that whoever wins two out of these three is a victor. Bahubali defeats his brother in all the three. And Bharata loses to his brother. But at that time something comes over Bahubali and he feels the futility in all this. He sees the futility in all this. And after defeating his brother, he goes to his brother and he tells that, I don't want any of this. All this is yours, you take. He gives up even his clothes, and that's why he becomes a Digambara. He gives up everything. He doesn't want even a piece of land to sit on. Therefore, he stands. And it is said that he does penance. 1 year he does penance, he doesn't move from that spot. Creepers grow around his foot and leg and plants start growing on him, but he doesn't move. But he doesn't even get Kevala Jnana with his penance.
Mm-hmm.
That is where the elder brother, you know, he comes and he tells his younger brother and he says that actually you are the lord of everything. You don't have to renounce anything because everything belongs to you. This whole thing belongs to you. It is only your compassion and magnanimity that you gave it to me. Please do not think that you are standing on my land. And it is said that the moment this, the elder brother tells and worships the feet, you know, that is the humility of the elder brother. When he worships the feet of Bahubali, who has now become like a rock, you know, he's almost a rock, immobile from the past 1 year. That is the moment which leads to him getting Kevala Jnana. It is said that all the while, though he had given up all his attachments, he still had that feeling that I am standing on my brother's land. Because of which Kevala Jnana eluded him. And after that, you know, he gets Kevala Jnana and he attains Nirvana. But he doesn't come back and establish a Sangha, because of which Bahubali is not considered a Tirthankara. But Bahubali is revered and worshipped. In fact, in Karnataka, every year there is one Utsavam where they bathe his entire idol and statue in milk.
Right.
You know, which is in a way strange, because the very purpose of Jainism and Buddhism was to stop idol worship and idolatry. But you can't help, because human nature is such, emotion is such, that though Buddha came and said no idolatry, now we have idols of Buddha himself. And that is what is it. So this is a very inspiring story of a person who gave up everything after having everything, you know. It is easy for me to give up the presidency of a country, because I am not a president of a country, you know. But to have all the power, to be everything, be all supreme, and yet in a trice, without batting an eyelid, to be able to give up, that requires amazing amount of willpower, want power, and renunciation. And that is what Bahubali did. And as I said, though he is not a Tirthankar, you will find this category of beings in Jainism where they are very inspiring. Though they are not Tirthankaras, they are very inspiring, and people look up to them for inspiration, motivation, and guidance on how to lead one's life.
And much of what you said in the form of that story is actually what defines the Jainism, the faith of Jainism itself. First of all, this idea that all of what we are going through is a journey towards perfection, or that Kevala Jnanam. So when you'll come across these many stories, I think quite recently also there was a story of an IIM graduate who was in a very good job, who gave up everything and embraced monkhood. A Jain monk he became. Because they always have this idea that you are journeying towards that. At any point you feel that you're mature enough to give up all the luxuries of the world, you are, you know, the parents will be more than happy to send their children away to embrace a path like that, because they believe that this is the goal. And I think that itself is a very beautiful aspect of the Jain religion, where from a young from childhood you're taught that this is the goal. You know, all of life is journeying towards this perfection. That is one aspect. The other is the idea of controlling the senses. All of the penance which Mahavira did, or these many monks and saints and sages who take up to very, very hard penance do, is a process of controlling the senses. I think that's what Swami would often say, that the central idea or the central precept of Jainism is the control of senses. The one who controls one's senses actually becomes a Mahavira, or the most courageous one. And the third aspect is the mix of non-violence and to help those around as much as possible. Of, as what Swami would put it very, very succinctly, as help ever and hurt never. I think these are the concepts which form the essence of Jainism. And if you look at it, how similar are they to the message that Swami gives, or for that matter any religion gives? Because as we started off with, the emphasis is different. The way these lessons are expressed or pursued are different. But I think the principles are the same, whichever the religion may be.
In conclusion, dear listeners, we will be reading out an excerpt from a discourse that Bhagwan delivered on the 25th of December 1991. It's amazing that every time Swami has spoken about Mahavira, it's been on Christmas. Anyway, interestingly, in that Swami says, in Jainism also, the same truth was taught by Mahavira. When the senses are allowed to have their way, all kinds of reactions occur. It is only when the senses are brought under control, under unified control, that the nature of divinity can be comprehended. The eyes have the power of sight. The ears can hear. The powers of all the sense organs, seeing, hearing, speaking, etc., are derived from the divine. It is the divine that enables the eyes to see, the ears to hear, the mind to think, and to have various experiences. It is when all these sensory processes are brought under unified control by the conquest of the senses that man becomes a conqueror or a jinnah, as termed by the Jains. Because he had mastered his senses, the title of victor was considered on him and he became Mahavira. This is what Swami said. And with that quote, dear listeners, we will conclude this discussion. Possibly just one more small, not a small, it's a big point actually, but I missed it. Another important tenet of the Jain philosophy, what Mahavira preached, is that in order to attain liberation from karmic matter, in order to cross the samsara, you need to be on the path of samyak darshana, samyak jnana, and samyak charitra. Samyak means good or right, the correct one. Samyak darshana is the right faith, samyak jnana is the right knowledge, and samyak charitra is right conduct. It reminds us of how Swami would give emphasis to all the students and say, have samyak drishti, which is right and good vision, samyak shravanam, good or right hearing. So it all begins with that, and it concludes with nirvana that Mahavira attained. So that, dear listeners, is the secret to becoming Mahavira. Controlling senses, going beyond the senses, finally becoming a jina. On that note, once again offering a gratitude to Swami for giving us this opportunity to delve into this beautiful religion. We bring this satsang to a close. We will end with a bhajan, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love.
Thank you. Dear listeners, you are listening to Radio Sai Global Harmony, bringing to you the message of Bhagawan Sri Satya Sai Baba.